Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today, Hugh Wilford. Hugh is a professor at Cal State Long Beach and also the author, as we talked about last time, of the new The CIA and Imperial History. So, Hugh, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me back. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm delighted. You're good on podcasts, so it makes my life easier. So last time we talked about overthrowing regimes. This time we're going to talk about maintaining them. And particularly we're going to talk about a man named Edward Lansdale, who's actually been the focus of a relatively significant literature. Was it Max Boot? It was one of the sort of like the center right guys who I think wrote a book about Lansdale. Maybe it was Max Hastings. I forget who.
Max Boot. You're right.
Yeah, Max Boot. One of the Maxes. But maybe you could tell us, and I think like we on the left oftentimes talk about Lansdale as well. And he's maybe the one CIA officer that people might actually know. So who was Lansdale? Why did you decide to write about him? And maybe we could talk about this larger process of regime maintenance that you chronicle in your book.
Sure. So Lansdale was ostensibly a colonel in the U.S. Air Force, but that was cover for his serving in the CIA. He, like so many of this early generation, he'd already served in the Office of Strategic Services during World War II. And he was less sort of kind of a Yaley type, less imperial brotherhood. I think we talked about that concept last time, than a lot of his contemporaries in the CIA. He was from a sort of a humbler background. He spent much of his early life on the West Coast. So he worked in the advertising industry previously before the war. So, and that was a big influence, I think, on his practice as an intelligence officer later on. And then when he was serving in the CIA, basically he specialized in, as you've already hinted, regime maintenance, so strengthening client regimes that the U.S. Wanted to see shored up against, you know, nationalist insurgencies and communist takeover. And he, I guess, showed how good he was at this, first of all, in the Philippines in the late 40s, early 50s, and then after that, a little bit like the way that Kim Roosevelt sort of became the coup guy. He became the regime maintenance guy and was shifted over to Vietnam in 1954, you know, just as the U.S. is trying to strengthen the anti-communist regime of South Vietnam.
So what does this mean, regime maintenance? What did he actually do? How do you maintain a regime?
Well, I guess it's first of all strengthening its internal security, so its intelligence services, its police force, etc. It's also about obviously strengthening it against possible foreign aggression as well. But it's also about legitimacy, I think, trying to win the support of the civilian population in the country in question. And that was very much something that Lansdale sort of specialized in. And he brought his considerable skills in PR, in advertising, or psychological warfare, as that was the term favored at the time, is still around a little bit now, I think, to bear on this. So It developed the name counterinsurgency. Lansdale is seen as a sort of an American founding father of counterinsurgency as a doctrine and as a practice. For me, the way he did it sort of looked sort of different from the US's imperial European predecessors. He was very much about sort of informality on the one hand. You know, there was none of the sort of condescending sort of racist attitudes of his colonial Western predecessors. And he was about making the government in question looking like it had this sort of democratic support of its local population. But as I try to show in the chapter, actually, although, you know, he more than anybody sort of in his generation, he should have been able to escape the imperial past, so to speak, because he wasn't really a sort of a card carrying member of the so-called Imperial Brotherhood. Yet the sort of the ghosts of the colonial past haunted him just as much as any of his CIA generation. And there are all sorts of echoes, I think, of the colonial past in what he was doing in places like the Philippines and Vietnam.
Can we talk a little bit about that? Like, I this is sort of the flip side of the covert action coin that we started talking about last time with overthrowing unfriendly regimes, protecting regimes that are in the club or in the tent. What were some of the origins of this in the European context that kind of brought this to the CIA in the first place? Like, how does this become a thing that the CIA is doing?
So I guess the obvious sort of figures from this kind of colonial prehistory that anticipated what the CIA was going to do with British political officers who were dispatched to India and then later Arab countries to sort of be in the background advising the local client regime as to how to proceed. There's the figure of the colonial proconsul as well. I sort of describe that through the figure of Hubert Leaute, the French imperial general of at the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, I guess. T. Lawrence of Arabia is a sort of latter-day version of the British imperial agent who is advising local rulers, in his case the Hashemite princes of the new Arab kingdoms that are created in the wake of the collapse of the Ottomans and during World War One. So that's the sort of, there is also, of course, a US prehistory here as well, because the United States had occupied the Philippines, and some of Lansdale was doing in the Philippines in the late 40s and early 50s, although it looked very different from the colonial past, nonetheless sort of echoed what was going on then. There were attempts sort of under William Howard Taft and the colonial government in the Philippines in the early years of the 20th century to sort of carry out various kind of projects to improve the Filipino infrastructure and so on. Lansdale was fond of talking about how he loved the foreign peoples among whom he was working, and it seems to me that that sort of looks different, right, from what European colonials were doing. Yet there have been talk of that as well in the early American colonial occupation. And his talk of he was also very fond of the term brother, and it occurred to me that actually he would describe the people with whom he was working as his brothers. And again, it seemed to me there was a sort of echo of the colonial past there, because William Howard Taft had talked about Filipinos as his little brown brothers. It's a mixture, I think, of this European colonial past and also what the Americans have been doing in the Philippines, kind of. It's always there in the background, even though Lansdale looks like a sort of a different figure.
And how does this relate to counterinsurgency, which it's funny, history is so, there's all these books about Lansdale because we were in Iraq and Afghanistan fighting counterinsurgencies, so we were looking to Vietnam. But how does Lansdale relate to counterinsurgency? And more broadly, how does counterinsurgency fit into what the CIA is becoming over the course of the 1960s as it expands and almost in a sense liberalizes its worldview to focus on not only coups, but development and modernization and these strategic Hamlet programs and participating in all of those efforts. So I think it might make sense to pause for a moment on this counterinsurgency issue.
Yeah. So he is apparently successful in the Philippines in terms of saving the regime there from a nationalist communist insurgency, the Hukbalahap insurgency. And entrenching the friend, the Filipino politician Ramon Magsaysay, as president there, and then moves on to, as I've already suggested, he moves on to Vietnam and tries to sort of work the same magic for the regime of Ngo Dinh Diem there, and it's about trying to win legitimacy. It's about trying to make these regimes popular with the local population, so that they the locals prefer them to the nationalist insurgent alternative. And a lot of that is about, as you say, modernization, development. Lansdale imports Filipino medical personnel to Vietnam to treat refugees from North Vietnam. He does something similar with an operation called the Freedom Brigade, when Filipino soldiers and even lawyers are brought in to advise the Zia regime about creating, you know, a democratic constitution. So it's about democratization. It's about modernization. And then after leaving the Vietnam in the late 50s, he goes back to Washington and working out of the Pentagon, actually, at this point, helps build up this doctrine of counterinsurgency. I think the phrase is first being used in the late 50s. And then with the election of John Kennedy, the White House becomes a sort of a center for counterinsurgency doctrine. And he is there, but he's also seen, I think, by some military leaders and senior personnel as well within the Kennedy administration, especially the Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, as a sort of rather eccentric figure. There are sort of he's known as the Lawrence of the Far East, and so he's just like T. Lawrence before him. Was sort of perceived as this slightly kind of insolent figure by, I think, a lot of British senior brass. He's kind of seen as somewhat having gone sort of native, I think, during his overseas tours, and he's kind of somewhat shunted to the side. So just the irony is that just as counterinsurgency is becoming established as this very important doctrine for in U.S. Foreign relations, he despite being sort of one of its American founders, is being sort of pushed to the margins, and I think that's seen by writers like Max Boot as a sort of, you know, a wrong turn, right? You know, if only you'd sort of carried on doing what Lansdale was doing, then perhaps we in Vietnam would have been, you know, saved the escalation, the militarization of the conflict that takes place in as the 1960s wears on.
And as you say in the book, Lansdale himself kind of represents the contradiction between this type of missionary idealism that defined the CIA and also, in your words, bloody, even illegal neo-colonial counterinsurgency. And this is ultimately the dialectic, in the sense, of the CIA. So how do you think about this, this genuine liberal ideal to improve these places that is accompanied by incredible violence and brutality, death and deracination, forced transfers of people, etc.? Is that just empire, and this is just what always happens in empire, or is there something more?
I think it's yes, basically, I think would be my brief answer to that question. You just see this sort of dynamic again and again, right? You see it with European colonists in the late 1800s and early 1900s, like Lyautey and his boss Joseph Gallieni, in places like Vietnam. The French, of course, were in Indochina, as well as North Africa and Madagascar. There's this initial attempt to carry out, I think, what modern counterinsurgency theorists would call population-centric counterinsurgency, which is you know, improving in infrastructure, trying to sort of win popular support and legitimacy for the regime in question. But then, as those efforts continue to encounter resistance, then the sort of glove comes off, and you start getting so-called enemy-centric measures instead. And you keep seeing this dialectic. It's also, of course, there in the Philippines, despite attempts by Taft and the earlier U.S. Government there to import American teachers and build up support for American values that way. Nonetheless, resistance continues. And you actually, as I was reading Daniel Immerwahr's How to Hide an Empire, there were passages about the U.S. General John Pershing, and how when he was in the Philippines in the early 1900s, he'd actually done things which are very like what Lansdale had done. Lansdale, as portrayed in a very sort of thinly veiled biographical portrait in The Ugly American by Lederer and Burdick, you know, he actually did this in real life. He went out into the countryside. He befriended insurgent peasants and tried to sort of just win them over with friendship, with demonstrations of brotherly love. And it turns out that John Pershing had done something very similar. He'd befriended local leaders but he also, when push came to shove, had resorted to violence as well. Though later, having done this, you know, he led troops into a village, and then there was a massacre of, I think, about 200 locals there. And you see something similar with Lansdale later on. At the same time that he is going out befriending locals, he is also friendly with members of the Filipino security forces, who were basically sending out death squads there was a unit called the NITA, run by a man called Napoleon Valeriano, who was a personal friend of Lansdale's, and you know, he just murdered the insurgents in gruesome fashion. So there's always these two sides, I think, of the counterinsurgency coin, and yeah, I mean, I think it is a function basically of empire, that, you know, that all of these interventions are seen. I mean, they're not seen as identical, of course, by local populations, but nonetheless, they're seen as unwanted interventions to be resisted, and the initial attempt to construct legitimacy for these regimes inevitably founders, and then the resort after that is, of course, to violence.
And then We're about to turn to the sort of at home section of the book. The book is divided into two parts, part one overseas, part two at home. As we sum up this part one, what should people take away from the CIA as in, you know, this is the imperial part in the sense of the imperial history. What are the large takeaways for listeners?
Well, I think it's that, like Lansdale, often the CIA officers of this first generation of the agency's existence were trying to do something new, something different, something better than our previous Western powers operating in the global South. Sherman Kent, sort of great U.S. in intelligence theorist was trying this scientific approach. Kermit Roosevelt saw himself, I think, as a friend of Arab nationalism. Lansdale, as we've just discussed, was sort of trying this informal anti-colonial, distinctively American, even loving approach. Yet, all kind of fell into, you know, similar traps that found themselves repeating the imperial past. And this was something, to some extent, they were sort of hardwired to do by virtue of their backgrounds, their upbringings, the culture from which they'd emerged. But it's also a function, I think, of post-World War II U.S. power in the world that basically, as we discussed at the beginning of the previous episode, the U.S.'s power in the world was that of an empire, except it was a moment when overt imperial power, for various reasons, could not really be exhibited, and therefore being successive U.S. administrations resorted to the covert powers of this new agency, which is also why I think increasingly covert operations become the CIA's chief mission as opposed to intelligence gathering as analysis, which was really what it was originally founded to do. And then as we'll, I think, probably discuss now, turning to the second half of the book, you see the effects of empire also being felt on the home front as, like, previous empires, what happens overseas doesn't stay there. Boomerang effects return to the home front.
So let's talk about friend of the pod, James Jesus Angleton, probably one of the most storied figures in the CIA's history. A very strange guy, inspired the Good Shepherd movie. Matt Damon's character was based on him. I believe he's Skull and Bones, you know, really the paradigmatic CIA guy. So who was this guy and how is he so crucial to counterintelligence in the CIA?
Well, he sets up counterintelligence within the CIA. I think he creates the counterintelligence staff in 1954, and he is still running it 20 years later. So he really is Mr. Counterintelligence in the early years of the CIA. And this is about protecting U.S. secrets rather than going out and trying to steal secrets from foreign powers. This is about this whole practice is about trying to protect American secrets from foreign espionage agents. He is, as you say, very sort of paradigmatic. He is a Yale. Is before that a British public school. I mean, he really sort of couldn't be more of the Imperial Brotherhood, so to speak, if he tried, in the sense that a lot of his contemporaries had been at sort of faux British boarding schools in the New England countryside. He actually sort of went to the real thing in England and very much sort of absorbed British imperial values there, returned to England during World War II, serving in X2, which is this sort of joint Anglo-American counterintelligence unit based in London. And he develops this passion for skill in the art of counterintelligence. He spends a lot of time in Italy as well. He's actually partly raised in Italy. His father is a businessman who has a business there for a number of years during his youth. Just one final thing to mention about him before I guess we get on to what he did in the CIA is he's also, like a lot of these figures, he's a writer as well, or at least he has strong literary associations. He edits, he helps found and edit a literary magazine at Yale, which is really quite a significant. It publishes Ezra Pound and various other major modernist poets. So he's really quite a kind of significant minor literary figure during the 1930s, and he maintains these associations later in his life. And therefore, when he's in London during the years of World War II, he's hanging out with T.S. Eliot. And so that's another interesting sort of element of Angleton's personality.
And do you think that relates to the CIA later funding modernists like Jackson Pollock? Like, there's this modernist fetishization, this sort of progressive looking forward that someone like Angleton represents, or is it just correlation, really?
I think there are overlaps there between the early CIA and modernism. There's quite a lot of these Ivy League educated young American men who end up in the CIA sort of know about modernist culture and also see themselves as sort of natural cultural patrons. It's also a function of the Cold War there. They're wanting to show the sort of the most sophisticated aspects, dimensions of American culture to foreign audiences, to persuade foreign intellectuals that the U.S. does have a sort of a high cultural life, which it shares with Western Europe, and therefore is a sort of, but you know, positioning the U.S. as a sort of natural defender of Western European high culture against possible communist takeover. And as you say, CIA money finds its way to a variety of sort of cultural causes, including traveling art exhibits, which feature American abstract expressionist painters like Jackson Pollock. So it's partly tactical. It's partly born out of this Cold War need to for the U.S. to give the lie to Soviet propaganda that all American culture is Mickey Mouse and hamburgers, right? But it is also, I think, a sort of a natural association, which you see in the literary taste of a figure like Angleton.
One more question I have about him, because if I recall correctly, Angleton had a really like intense World War II experience. And something that I always thought about a lot of these guys is that that experience really, like, obviously this is a great insight, shaped who they were. And they emerged from the war kind of different. Wasn't Angleton parachuted behind the lines? Like, there were some like wild experiences that some of these guys had in Nazi-occupied Europe. And I was just curious, right, what this World War II experience just really seems crucial to their early CIA.
Oh, yeah, I think it is. It does really loom over the early CIA. You're absolutely right. In Angleton's case, I think it was, I'm not sure that he was parachuted behind enemy lines. A number of his CIA contemporaries were. They'd served in a unit called the Jedburghs.
Yes, it's someone else. The one who disappeared later. His name is escaping me, but he was a Jedburgh. Right, that's what it was.
Right, okay, yeah, yeah. These sort of joint U.S., British, and French outfits that right, yeah, operated behind enemy lines, and you know, so
I was thinking William Colby.
Oh, you're thinking
was
Colby?
Jedburgh.
Yeah, that makes a later CIA director for sure. That is crucial, and you know, it understandably, these are acts of incredible bravery. It creates this, you know, in an undoubtedly, you know, righteous and just cause. So I think it very much creates this fierce sense of moral purpose and moral righteousness, right? Going forward, these are people who very much don't really sort of question that what they are doing is the right thing, and that they have the right to exercise this huge secret power, and that kind of what they do basically is right. I think that's in, and also I think a sort of, you know, a sense of camaraderie, this sort of, you know, an intimate masculine camaraderie. You see that again and again, I think, in the early CIA. These are people, you know, who served together in life and death situations during World War II, and you know, established really important relationships with foreigners as well, in Europe and sometimes overseas. I mean, there were further overseas than that. There were relationships established between people in the OSS and, you know, nationalist freedom fighters, right? Guerrillas in resisting the Japanese occupation in places like Vietnam, for example. So a lot of this does go sort of back to World War II. It's ground zero. I think you're absolutely right for a lot of what follows.
Yeah. So let's turn to Angleton and what does he actually do when he's doing counterintelligence in the CIA? Because this is, I think, really as crucial as what the CIA does abroad to really shaping public perceptions of what the CIA is.
Yeah, so he works in conditions of extraordinary secrecy. He sort of, I think this is something that, again, that he learns in London during World War II, because he, along with other US members of X2, were inducted into super secret British wartime operations against the Nazis, such as the code breaking ultra operation Double Cross, when Nazi spies were sort of turned and sent back against Nazi Germany. And all of this was incredibly sort of compartmented and surrounded by these extremely strong secrecy measures. And Angleton replicates this within CIA counterintelligence. He's kind of obsessive. He pours pretty much, you know, all of his energy and all of his time into countering the possible threat of, now of course, Soviet espionage during the Cold War years. He's very powerful within the early CIA. He has the sort of right of veto over possible covert operations, which he sees if he sees them as terrible security risks. And so he isn't, you know, he and his counterintelligence staff aren't necessarily liked by the rest of the CIA. Even within the agents, he develops a reputation for being kind of like weird, and it's perhaps not helped by the fact that he's doing things like his counterintelligence staff is running operations like HT Lingual, which is a mail opening operation. U.S. mail with the Soviet Union is being sort of, envelopes are being steamed open and read as they sort of go through post office machinery, and this is so, and so he already sort of, even in the 50s, he's skirting a little bit close to the sort of the limits of what the CIA should be doing on American soil, because it is, you know, it's a foreign intelligence agency prohibited from domestic operation by the National Security Act of 1947. So he's working in incredible secrecy. He is taking measures that are perhaps a little legally dubious already. He's this kind of rather sinister, he's a very gaunt man, a slightly kind of sinister personal presence. He's famous for his sort of his personal hobbies like orchid growing and fly fishing. He's kind of like, he's a sort of eccentric weirdo, right? Even within the CIA. So he has this kind of this personal legend, as well as this a lot of just bureaucratic power within the intelligence community.
And how does his role in the CIA change over time? So I have two questions. How does he fall? And then second, what in terms of causal importance do you think the CIA counterintelligence efforts had when you're talking about the Black Freedom Movement and things like that? Is it really they're coming apart due to CIA counterintelligence, or is this just a small part of a much larger process? Because I think in the left-wing imagination, it's quite large, but I'm curious what you think.
Right. So come the 60s, this kind of skirting are pretty close to illegality on the domestic front. It gets supercharged in the late 60s because of the rise of the anti-imperial left and Black Panthers and various anti-Vietnam War organizations. And Angleton's counterintelligence staff is ordered. He doesn't actually initiate this, in fairness to him. This comes from, first of all, the Johnson White House, and then later directives from the Nixon administration are basically told to start investigating the possibility that the New Left and the anti-war movement are basically being controlled by the communist powers. He's canny. He's a very shrewd bureaucratic operator, and he actually kind of delegates control because he knows how dicey this is legally. He hands this over to an underling called Richard Ober, who runs this operation, MH Chaos, that basically involves surveilling various anti-war personalities and organizations, and the Black Panthers as well. It contributes, I think, to the breakup of the New Left in the very late 60s and early 70s, because you know these individuals and groups are very much aware that they are being surveilled. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI is running COINTELPRO at this point, so another surveillance operation that's possibly even more sort of intrusive. And actually, you know, the FBI is explicit, at least within its own ranks, about the fact that this operation is partly designed to sort of create paranoia and conflict within the ranks of the New Left. And the CIA's chaos program sort of feeds into this, and I think it does contribute to the breakup of the New Left as a movement during the early 70s. But ultimately, of course, it returns to haunt Angleton, because at just the point that the sort of New Left is breaking down, some of its kind of anti-war values are going sort of mainstream, and you're getting that whistleblowers are coming out of the CIA itself and exposing some of the sorts of questionable activities that it's been up to in the shape of operations like Chaos. And ultimately, this really does for Angleton. But it's not just that, as I think your question was hinting at. He is also his own sort of increasing paranoia has given rise to this very destructive mole hunt that he carries out during the 60s and early 70s, which kind of destroys a number of CIA careers. It more or less incapacitates the agency's espionage operations within the Soviet bloc. And for all of these reasons, William Colby, actually, who's director by this point, the man we just mentioned a moment ago, who's never particularly liked Angleton. There's always been personal tension between them, between the mole hunt and then the exposure of operations like Chaos. Colby eventually decides that he has to get rid of Angleton, and Angleton is effectively forced to resign in 1974.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
So let's move into the next chapter of the book, which talks about publicity. And this is an interesting, I think, way to look at this, because on the one hand, you're talking about a spy agency, and publicity does not necessarily come along with a lot of the things that the CIA is doing. And yet, as you note in the book, there is this strong link between, you know, what the agency does and the idea of storytelling, certainly the idea of propaganda. So there's a lot of kind of overlapping. A lot of these guys seem to fancy themselves as, kind of failed literateurs. They go into, you know, they try to write books and so there's a lot of kind of crossover here. And this comes together in the book in the person of Cord Meyer. But let's sort of start with just kind of the what is the CIA's approach to publicity? And then, you know, who is Cord Meyer? How does he become kind of the central figure in this part of the story?
Yeah, sure. Great question. So I guess the CIA is mainly is carrying out publicity propaganda work overseas in operations like the sort of the literary cultural ones we were talking about a moment ago, in order to, because the Cold War is so much a battle for hearts and minds, right? It's about trying to generate foreign support for the American cause. That's where the CIA's focus mainly is, appropriately, given it's a foreign intelligence agency. Somebody like Cord Meyer, another Yale-educated, first-generation CIA officer, a close friend of Angleton's, himself, another literary figure, a very accomplished writer in his own right. He's running these sort of cultural Cold War operations for much of the 1950s and the 1960s. Sort of really interesting, brilliant, but sort of the sort of gloomy man. Perhaps partly because he was World War II, I think, was crucial for him as well. He was badly wounded, lost an eye actually, in fighting in the Pacific, and his twin brother was killed around the same time as well. And he sort of seems to, from that point onwards, he's kind of has this sense of the sort of tragic nature of life. He's this kind of surprise. He's almost a Dostoevskian sort of figure. But anyway, he is overseeing CIA publicity propaganda operations overseas. But there's also, and the reason I talked about these in the second half of the book is this does also have a domestic component. It's partly that a lot of these overseas propaganda operations involve funding American citizen groups, right? Like, you know, artists, intellectuals, labor groups. There are extraordinary number of these different front groups, you know, ostensibly independent organizations that are apparently being funded by private foundations, yet actually those foundations are sort of conduits for covert U.S. funding. And these go into the domestic sphere because the people in these organizations who are being covertly funded by the CIA are apparently independent non-government U.S. citizens. So there is that, but there is also, and this is kind of what I focused on to a great extent in this chapter, that there are also front groups that I think are about, in this sense, again, I think there's an echo of the European imperial past. A lot of these groups, I think, are about sort of generating a popular American support for U.S. interventions in the global South, in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, you know, places about which the great majority of Americans know very little, about which they probably don't care a whole heck of a lot. So there are these organizations that are CIA fronts that are somewhat about overseas propaganda work, but also I think about, they groups with names like the American Friends of the Middle East and the American Society of African Culture, which I think are about sort of, they're partly sort of domestic, inward facing, right? And they're about sort of trying to generate, produce popular support for, interest in, sympathy with, you know, concern about these foreign countries. And then finally, just I should also mention, because this is also in the chapter, and it's a part of the CIA's publicity work, is just simple PR as well, right? The CIA is always caught between the fact that it's different in this respect from, say, British spy agencies, which really are secret, as I think you discussed with Simon Wilmots. I mean, the UK government doesn't admit to the existence of MI6 until the 1990s. So, but everybody knows the CIA exists. So the CIA is sort of caught between, you know, being secret, yet at the same time knowing that it needs congressional funding, right? It has to have some sort of support for itself from the US media and Congress and so on. So it also somewhat kind of reluctantly, ambivalently engages in sort of its own public relations work as well, at the same time as it's performing these propaganda operations geared towards the Cold War.
So I think to kind of take us to the end of the book and the end of this two-part interview, and again, we urge anybody who wants to learn more about the history of the CIA to pick this up. It's a tremendous book. You close the last chapter, there's a little epilogue on the War on Terror, but you close with a chapter on unintended consequences. Can you talk a little bit about why you did that, why you made that choice, and then sort of what are some of these unintended consequences? I know one of them that will come to mind for everybody is the sort of conspiracy theory, the kind of, the lack of trust in the American state, or the idea of the deep state. And that's part of it. But there are other unintended consequences that you get into the chapter. Maybe you could outline what some of those are.
Sure. Yeah, I guess I felt that the domestic sort of blowback boomerang effects of CIA operations overseas, they weren't just intended ones. You know, there were chapters about counterintelligence, about domestic publicity work, but these were intended domestic interventions, but that I felt there were also consequences of what the CIA was doing overseas that were felt within America domestically, which weren't necessarily intended by the agency. And these included population flows, right? CIA regime maintenance operations that ultimately failed, such as the most obviously the ones in Vietnam and the one in Iran as well, with, you know, the events of 1975 and then the Iranian in Vietnam and then the Iranian Revolution in 1979. These lead to influx of populations from those countries within to the US, which are kind of a little bit like, you know, population flows from European colonies to the European countries such as France and Britain that you see in the post-World War II period, the demographic workings out of the impacts of overt empire. They're sort of the equivalent ones in the US, except they come from the CIA's covert empire. So there's the creation of these sort of refugee Iranian Vietnamese communities within the United States. I'm kind of very much in the territory here of Viet Thanh Nguyen's The Sympathizer. You know, it's a great 2015 novel that became, I think, an HBO drama series, which is about sort of how this this plays out in Southern California, and this with this communist mole who is carrying on his sort of spying activities, but on U.S. soil rather than in Vietnam, and has his reputation with this sort of rather Edward Lansdale like CIA character. So there's that. There's the impacts of various overseas CIA operations on American academe, on various sort of Cold War academic disciplines, especially I think anthropology and most of all psychology. I write a bit about CIA programs in psychological research, like MK Ultra, which really, you know, were very impactful in basically all sorts of harmful ways. On
did it contribute to Manson? What's your take on that? Is that why Manson did it?
There's that. Is it Tom O'Neill novel?
Book about which is
a really great read in many respects. But like a lot of these books, there are just some sort of leaps, right? Evidentiary leaps, which I don't think are really justified. So I think the answer is no. I don't think that Manson was a product of MK Ultra, which isn't to say that this kind of mind control program that the CIA was running, although which isn't to say that, I mean, there are clearly it has other unintended consequences. There are a lot of people sort of in California who get roped into these experiments that have been run out of, you know, Californian universities. I think I have a paragraph on how sort of another unintended consequence is that the MKUltra sort of feeds into the Bay Area sort of counterculture, because Allen Ginsberg takes LSD under the auspices of I think it's a Stanford. Anyway, you know, one of Ken Casey does as well. You know, but Charles Manson, I'm not sure I'd go that far, and I think that plays into something that Derek was alluding to, which also features in this chapter. It's the sort of third segment of this final chapter, which is how all of these CIA activities generate conspiracy theories about the agency. It's another sort of unintended consequence, which kind of bites the agency, right? I was struck by how... pretty much all of my major characters, I guess somewhat with the exception of Sherman Kent, do eventually feature in CIA conspiracy theories, which, you know, it's partly this emerges from America's rich prior history of conspiracy theorizing, right? It can't blame it all on the CIA and what the Cold War National Security State is doing overseas, but nonetheless, it's kind of supercharged, I think, this conspiracism by the fact that the Cold War era sees the emergence of this massive secret national security apparatus and agencies like the CIA with these huge covert powers, which have effects on the home front. It was perhaps inevitable that the CIA would become a focus of conspiracy theory. And in this chapter, I sort of trace how, in particular, JFK conspiracy theory sort of gradually drag in pretty much, you know, Cord Meyers is his wife, actually Cord Meyers' first wife. There's a lot of conspiracy theory attached to the fact that she was murdered in an unsolved case just a year after JFK, and she had been having an affair with Kennedy, and so understandably perhaps and apparently took drugs with Kennedy, and anyway, and the fact that she was actually the former wife of this high-ranking CIA officer, understandably, perhaps an awful lot of conspiracy theory sort of was attracted to the figure of Mary Meyer. So, or Angleton, Lansdale, Lansdale is supposedly appears in photographs and from Dallas in 1963. All of these characters become the focus of conspiracy theorizing in this other sort of unintended consequence of covert empire, which it turns out that if you play with these sort of forces, you can't entirely control them, right? And I think there's an element of what's going on.
So you, again, we're at the end of the book, and you do have this epilogue on the War on Terror. So why don't we, as a final question, to cover that piece of it, what does the War on Terror do to the agency in terms of the imperial kind of narrative that you're telling?
Sure. Well, I mean, on the one hand, obviously the because of 9/11 and then the WMD debacle, the War on Terror is a disaster for the agency, but also ironically, it becomes the sort of the frontline soldier, I guess, in the War on Terror, in terms of it's given control of. Well, first of all, the RRDI capturing and interrogating terrorist suspects, and also then targeted killing, right? Assassinating terrorists via drones, which is in a program again operated by the CIA. So it both undermines it and gives it these powers again, Powers not visualized, I don't think, by anyone in 1947 when the agency was first created as basically an intelligence, not a covert action agency. So I guess in my epilogue, I write about those events, but I, rather than describing them all in tremendous detail, I try and return to my argument about the imperial shadows looming over the CIA, and go into how both the CIA's conduct of the War on Terror overseas and then its domestic repercussions, really how they again echoed earlier imperial events in terms of, I compare the failure to anticipate 9/11, or at least provide actionable intelligence about 9/11. The CIA had predicted attacks on the homeland, but I sort of compare that with earlier imperial intelligence failures. I note similarities between the Iraq and the Iraqi and Afghan governments that the CIA was trying to help defend. Those governments and earlier colonial regimes. I build on the work of Priya Satya, Stanford historian, who noted that CIA drone campaigns over Afghanistan and Pakistan kind of echoed earlier British bombing campaigns during the 1920s by the British Royal Air Force over those regions. There are eerie similarities between what the RAF was doing during the days of the British Mandate in the Middle East and what the CIA was doing with its drone program and so on. So again, I'm sort of revisiting that thesis that really, the CIA is not necessarily consciously and intentionally doing the work of empire, but nonetheless, what it's doing in the global South has these extremely strong echoes of things that prior Western empires had done in those regions.
Again, folks, Hugh Wilford, the book is The CIA in Imperial History. Definitely go out and pick it up. Please do it. It's a fantastic book, really, if you're at all interested in understanding the role the CIA has played in American history for the last going to be a century soon enough. Jesus. If you're interested in that, this is an absolute must read. So, Hugh, thank you so much for coming on the program and doing these two shows with us.
Oh, it's been nothing but a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
First, there was Tuesday. Then there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.